Hey there, and welcome to Cyberpunk Librarian. I'm Daniel Messer. There is nothing that cements in your mind just how much crap you own, more than picking it up, putting it in boxes, and shifting it from one point on the planet to another. I hate moving. It's not so much the physical work, which is considerable. No, I hate the stress that just comes from not having all your stuff put away, not being able to find your stuff, and the general malaise of, where in the heck do I put this thing? Also, it takes a lot of time out of your life, and for a good month you're either planning to move, moving, putting stuff away from the move, or recovering from the move. It's insanity. So, to be perfectly honest, I didn't have time to write up an episode. Heck, this is going out a day late because of, what else? Moving. There will be a little something different here, yet it's something I've done before. It's a format I've borrowed from a friendly Belgian called Nightwise, where I play some chill music and read to you. Granted, this is still Cyberpunk Librarian, and yes, there will be stuff about technology, and we will explore the intersection of libraries and technology. But for this episode, we'll be just a little more down-tempo about it. Literally. We'll pick up the tech and the tips and the nifty library tricks next episode, because by then, most everything should be out of boxes and into places where they should be. But for now, kick back, let yourself relax a bit, and come with me. This, ladies and gentlemen, is a grand tradition in the library world, because this, ladies and gentlemen, is story time. This is Cyberpunk Librarian, episode 21, Storytime. My name is Daniel Messer, your friendly neighborhood cyberpunk librarian, and hey, welcome back to the show that explores the intersection of libraries and technology and is all about living that high-tech, low-budget lifestyle. So, if you happen to be tuning in because you read about the show in the AZLA newsletter, welcome to the show. The Arizona Library Association gave me a lovely write-up in their monthly newsletter, and that was really cool of them. I'd like to send a big thank you out to that. And if you're, you know, here because you read about that in the newsletter, welcome to the show. And of course, if you're a regular listener or a person who has been with me for the last 21 episodes, welcome back anyway. I thank all of you for tuning in. So this will be kind of a different episode because, well, like I said in the intro, I've been moving, and moving takes a whole lot of time, and when you have a whole lot of time devoted to moving, you don't have a whole lot of time to sit down and write out something decent for a podcast episode. So instead, we're going to do a little something different, which I've done before, and this is the kind of thing that I like to do when life happens and events work really hard to transpire against me and make sure I can't get something decent down in the digital realm so I can record it with some measure of intelligence. So this is story time, where I'm going to pick a couple of down-tempo songs, something that's easy to listen to, something that should relax you a little bit, and then we'll just simply have a couple of articles that do apply to libraries and technology, but aren't so much with the high-tech sort of, this is how you accomplish great things using open source tech kind of thing. So, if you're driving in a car, you might not want to kick back, you might not want to close your eyes and relax, and you might not want to adjust your headphones to a comfortable listening volume, because you are, after all, in a car. And being in a car is one of those things where you just don't want to do that. It's dangerous to you and the other people on the road. So if you're in a car, do none of those things. Keep your attention on the road. But, you know, make sure that the other people around you can stay alive and that you yourself stay alive and get to your destination safely. But if you already happen to be at your destination, and you can kick back and you can adjust your headphones to a comfortable listening volume, and you can kind of close your eyes and just sort of come with me as we delve into a couple of articles about Kindles and why I don't like multiple monitors. Now, I know this doesn't sound all that enlightening, but I hope to make it at least somewhat interesting. Thanks for tuning in, and hey, why don't we just get started?
I couldn't possibly tell you. It's here. Can't you feel it? This whole room. Everything is in color, and I can feel the air. I can see it. I can see all the molecules.
I'm trying.
Kindles don't have covers, or the return of the penny dreadful. You know what I like to read? And I mean, you know what I really like to read? I like to read deep, thought-provoking science fiction. The kind where you sit back every so often and think, yeah, not only could such and such happen, but the author totally nailed the human condition and the human response if that did happen. I love reading essays, especially short, well-written essays like the classics from Isaac Asimov, who, coincidentally, was also a science fiction author. I like to read Christopher Hitchens' essays because they're awesome and they make me think. I like to read insightful scientific stuff by Neil deGrasse Tyson or Brian Greene. I love to read history, especially the history of science or the history of Japan. Scientists and/or samurais are pretty hard to beat. And sometimes, I like to read about people f***ing. That doesn't mean the occasional romance story with cuddling, cooing, soft lighting, and making love at midnight. I mean bodies slapping, and the only thing that's missing is the bad disco soundtrack. I also, on occasion, pick up something bizarre. Something that's not pornographic, but man, the title alone would be enough to twist one's brain. For instance, there's a book called The Driver's Guide to Hitting Pedestrians. There's another one called Ass Goblins of Auschwitz. Then there's The Egg Said Nothing, which sounds fairly sedate, yet the cover would draw some interesting stares on the bus, especially from the more interesting people who may not actually be so interesting to you. There's another really good book called Just Friends by Ann Thomas. It's a romance novel about a guy who totally falls for and has some marvelous sex with another guy. While attitudes have changed towards homosexuality, I'm kind of a low-key person and don't really need jerks approaching me and sermonizing about the quote-unquote sinful literature that I'm reading. Sometimes, I do want a fairly standard romance novel that may or may not have hardcore sex. I'm a librarian. In order to properly serve my patrons, I need to read any genre there is. At least that's my cover story. I don't want to deal with the crowd of people who'd frown on a dude reading Phantom Waltz, nor do I particularly care to harmonize with those who might think it's awesome. I'm reading. Leave me alone. All this brings me to my point, something I tried to cram down my dear readers' throats in the title. Have you ever noticed that Kindles have no covers? Neither do other ebook readers, but the words Nook tablets have no covers just didn't flow properly for me. There are a couple of things that are awesome about this development of coverless reading, and you'll see more of them, especially after people open their presents on Christmas. Since an ebook reader doesn't have a cover, I can sit in a coffee shop, on a bus, kick back against a wall outside the library, or stand in line at a supermarket and read my book. And no one needs to know that I'm reading The Gentleman's Guide to the Golden Age of Ménage à Trois. Sadly, that's not a real book. This bit of increased anonymity means that one can enjoy their guilty reading no matter where they go or what they're doing. Seriously, I'd say most of us have read a book that we want to keep reading, to take it with us, but the fear of maybe social ostracism that might occur if we go out with a book sporting a cover like Lawrence Block's Getting Off, which features a totally naked woman with a butcher knife between her butt cheeks. Yeah, you could see the problem. But did you notice something about most of the books I just mentioned? They're fairly inexpensive, even as far as Kindle books go. They're especially inexpensive when you compare them to Kindle editions of the latest bestsellers. It makes them attractive for a lot of reasons. First, at those costs, they're an impulse purchase. If I'm looking to read something fun, and you give me a list of fun books, I'll look at many things, but one of those things will be the price. I can buy Super Awesome Bestseller for $14.99, or I can read this thing over here that looks interesting for $3.99. Heck, for $3.99, I can buy four things instead of just one. And even if they're not the best writing in the world, nothing like a great American novel. They're fun, and they're cheap, and I can have more of them. This isn't a new business model at all. There used to be these things called penny dreadfuls that were the predecessors of the pulp magazines of the mid-20th century. They were cheap, sure. Of course, the writing contained therein was one step above or below highlights for children. In some cases, they wrote stories about real people, but the stories were full of lies, damn lies, and fabrications. But by God, they were entertaining. Then, just like now, people would cock a sneer at you for reading such tripe, trashy literature. Many would, in the style of Capote, tell you that that's not even writing, it's merely typing. There's truth to that, and as an ardent fan of Truman Capote, I agree, and I do love to read things like In Cold Blood. But I also love to read murder mysteries, involving shabbily dressed alcoholic detectives who are as likely to throw up at a crime scene as they are to investigate it, and yet for some reason they totally get the hot girl in the end. Oh, and the victim? Yeah, they died with clown makeup on their face, and that face was wrapped in a plastic bag. Now that, my friends, is entertainment, and it's cheap. Patrons of our libraries are no different than any other readers, except for a fact that it's a safe bet that a regular library patron reads more than the average reader. They want those amazing award-winning novels, and sometimes they want absolute trash. Trash in all of its wonderful, fun, and entertaining glory. And now they can have it. They can have it easily. They can even check the stuff out without ever looking a librarian in the eye. A librarian, one who is the ultimate judge of literary character. Well, we are, aren't we? So let me ask you, will your library stock it? I'm not worried about collection development ethics or whether it's not something, you know, whether or not something is too filthy for your collection. I'm talking about a lot of collection development policies that basically run towards archaic ideas of, well, if we wouldn't put it on our shelves, we don't want it in the e-collection. Or, it doesn't have a starred review in two major book review magazines, and Publishers Weekly never even mentioned it. Or my favorite, this looks like it's self-published or published by some tiny independent press. We don't add that kind of stuff to our collection. Well, let me give you a word of advice, and by that I mean five words of advice. Rethink your collection development policies. Librarians are finally accepting that the ebook revolution is upon us, and bucko, come next Christmas, you're going to see another massive explosion of interest in ebooks. There's a complementary revolution going on alongside this that has just as much to do with the soaring popularity in ebooks, and you ignore it at your peril. Amazon and BNN both have made it incredibly easy to self-publish and have your work displayed in one big online store. And before one discredits self-publishing as vanity, let me hit you with one last fact before I get out of here. Oscar Wilde, Edgar Rice Burroughs, Christopher Paolini, Beatrix Potter, Louis L'Amour, James Redfield, Virginia Woolf. These are just a few of the famous authors that you will most likely find on a library shelf. All of them writers, all of them self-publishers. One of the founding fathers of the United States was a notoriously unabashed and completely unashamed self-publisher, none other than Benjamin Franklin. If you have a bias against cheap, self-published or independently published books, especially if they happen to be ebooks, I advise you to get over it. Welcome to the new world of publishing and the new frontier in reading, which, as the Penny Dreadful illustrates, isn't actually so new after all. It only takes one. Monitors are a feisty thing to many geeks. You'll hear from some of us about how multiple monitors are a must. The more monitors, the better, and that you need at least two to be really productive. You can browse the Battle Station subreddit and find pictures of all kinds of computer setups that will make you weep with envy. And almost all of them have some multi-monitor thing going on. Some have two, others three, others will have four or five. They're all set up side by side or side by side by side with one mounted above or side by side with an overhead and then a connection to the HDTV on the wall. There are hundreds of ways to set this stuff up. I've used a bi-monitor and tri-monitor setup at home and at work. I've coded websites and the occasional app on these kinds of setups, where I've got my IDE or Dreamweaver on one monitor, my email on another, and a browser in the third so I can check my edits as I work on the website. I've done this for a long time, and I didn't give it much thought until I got my current gig as a web content guy for the library. The job came with a 27-inch monitor, which is bigger than any single monitor I've ever used. To me, it's huge, and it's still huge even after all this time using it. After that space of time, I realized something. I don't need a lot of monitors. I just need a big one. Now, I know geeks all over will look at that statement and say, well, yeah, but what about two big monitors? Can you imagine what you'd accomplish on two 27-inch monitors? Yes. Yes, I can. I can accomplish exactly the same amount of stuff as I can do on one. I multitask pretty well, but my style of work and the work that I typically do doesn't flow well on multiple monitors. That's just a function of my own workflow, but I'm certain there are others like me. Look, I'm paid to make stuff, and I create things for fun in my spare time, too. You're actually listening to one of those things. When I'm coding stuff for the library site, I'm looking at Dreamweaver or Aptana Studio, and I'm looking at the code. That's all I'm looking at, the code. I don't give a damn about email because I'm busy with this code, so I don't need a monitor showing my email. I'm not going to look at it anyway because I'm coding. I'm not worried about Spotify or Clementine or anything providing me with music because once I fire that off, I don't have to look at it. After all, when you turn on the radio, do you keep constantly looking at the radio? I bet you just listen to it without looking at it at all, since that's fairly the correct way to use a radio. When I'm working on anything creative, I have a focus. And if I have to pick, I want a big window of focus, and everything else can simply fade away into the background. Sure, while I code a website, I've got a browser open to that site, but it's in the background. Alt-tab to the browser, and then F5 refreshes the site. I note the changes, figure out what's next, Alt-tab back to Aptana Studio, and go back to work. The browser isn't doing anything for me unless I need to verify my code, so there's no point in it having its own monitor, because even if it was on its own monitor, I'd be ignoring it anyway. This same is true with Photoshop or GarageBand or Final Cut Pro or my favorite text editor in Linux. In case you're wondering, it's Kate. When I'm illustrating something in Photoshop, I want a big-ass canvas to work on. When I'm composing in GarageBand, I want to see as many tracks as possible so I can time things properly. I want to see as much of my footage on screen with iMovie or Final Cut so I don't have to find things as often. And when I write, I need a blank screen and a cursor. When I started using a large monitor, I noticed something about my behavior on multiple monitors. It didn't matter what was on each one. I was only paying attention to one thing at a time anyway. So Outlook is up on my left monitor. I'm not reading email, I'm not sending email, so what do I care? Okay, Firefox is taking up the primary monitor, but if I'm not using the web at that point, what's it to me? That's when I discovered that what I really need is a large area to focus on, and everything I'm not interested in at that moment can cease to exist, at least temporarily. When I'm working on something that requires concentration, I tend to close out unnecessary stuff anyway. That unnecessary stuff means extraneous folders on the desktop, unneeded programs, apps I'm not using, and email. Heck, especially email. There's nothing so crazy-making to me as being in the middle of an idea, and Outlook's toaster thingy pops up on screen, and my eyes dart to it, and I lose my train of thought. Well, if I have a productivity tip for you, it's this. Screw email. There's a great Walter Matthau movie called The First Monday in October where he plays a Supreme Court justice. And there's a line in there that I absolutely adore where he says, "The telephone has no constitutional right to be answered." Guess what? Neither does email. I get email all day from people who could easily walk to my desk and talk to me. I figure if it's really important, they'll come talk to me. If it's not that important, then they'll send it via email. When I go to work on something and I don't want to be interrupted, I kill Outlook first. I heartily suggest that you do the same. People send stuff through email when they don't care much about it. Everything else is delivered by a process server and he has you sign for it. So, all of you people out there working on multiple monitors, maybe you have that multi-focus thing that I lack. Maybe, you know, you're doing a different job, that you can look from one thing to another without worrying about a single task. But I don't. And almost nothing I do allows me to split my attention in such a way. Try it, if you can. Ditch the multiple monitors and get one big one. It changed my workflow completely, and totally for the better. Wraps up this episode of Cyberpunk Librarian. I do thank you for tuning in, for catching us on your podcatcher of choice, or maybe you listened in on the website at cyberpunklibrarian.com/podcast. little something laid back, a little something down tempo, because boy oh boy, I needed to de-stress from the move. And this is the kind of thing that really does help. And hey, you get a show, you get something that's new as far as a perspective on the Kindle, and maybe you give that big monitor a shot. I mean, if you like the multiple monitors, that's great. But I do urge you that if you have the ability to hook up to just one big monitor, for instance, my 32-inch HD TV here at home that is my monitor, yeah, give that a shot, because I think you'll find that, like me, you're only concentrating on one thing at a time anyway. So if you've only got that singular focus, may as well be a large singular focus. So throw that up on a big screen and maybe you find that you don't need all of those monitors after all. The music you're currently digging on is Narita Spaceport Lounge by Kevin Bryce, and earlier in the show we heard Cohen Method by Tab and Anatech. If you go all the way back to the beginning, that was Tesseract by some guy named Daniel Messer, but no one's ever heard of him. However, you can pick up those first two songs at the Free Music Archive. FreeMusicArchive.org, all kinds of genres, styles, new stuff that you have never heard of, but great stuff nonetheless. I suggest that you check it out. Head over there, find a genre you like, and just press play. You're going to find something awesome. The opening track, as always, is Belly Dance at Ebisu by Ryo Miyoshita, and you can also pick that up at the Great Free Music Archive. The show itself is hosted by the Internet Archive, archive.org, great people doing great things, preserving and saving the internet and the online world. The Internet Archive has all kinds of great stuff, from Let's Play videos on classic Commodore 64 video games to the Prelinger Archives, moving pictures, and of course, podcasts like this one. Check them out, Internet Archive at archive.org. If you would like to get in touch with me, you can certainly do so via email at cyberpunklibrarian@gmail.com. If you'd like to hit me up on Twitter, I am at Bibrarian. That is B-I-B-R-A-R-I-A-N. It is like a librarian, but with a B. And if you want to hit me up on my social network of choice, Google+, I am google.com/+DanielMesser. If you got an idea for a show, got a comment, got some feedback, whatever, by all means, get in touch with me. I would love to hear from you. And with that, we are going to wrap up the show. I will see you again in 2 weeks for another episode of Cyberpunk Librarian, where we will get back into the technical, the techie, the geeky, the technological, all kinds of wonderful computery stuff. But hey, you know, sometimes you need a little downtime, sometimes you need a little story time, and sometimes you need to be reminded that you don't have to be high-tech to be low-budget, but it certainly helps if you're a cyberpunk. Take care. I'll see you next time.